Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. I'm your host, Ejaz Jasil. Today, we're continuing a years-long discussion that we've dedicated to suspensions in the Buffalo public school system. Today, we're taking a look at an agreement announced last month between Attorney General Letitia James and the Buffalo public school system following a years-long civil rights investigation into the district's suspensions practices. I'm pleased to be joined today by Jessica Bauer-Walker, community health worker. Thank you so much for being here, for being back here.
Mm-hmm.
And also Sam Radford, parent advocate and leader in the Buffalo community for over 30 years. Thank you so much for being here as well, Sam.
Thank you.
So first, I would like to, before we get into the nitty-gritty of the AG's findings and this agreement, I want to start with your overall reactions. A lot was laid out here. And I'm interested in learning what, if anything, surprised you about the AG's findings and what either confirmed or validated what you've already been concerned about.
Well, you know, I will start with it was a validation. Just the AOD in itself was a validation. You know, we've been advocating on this issue since 2010, you know, so to finally get to a place where the things that parents have been saying, the thing that parents have been experiencing have been, you know, acknowledged and, you know, a plan has put together to hold the district accountable for complying with the law.
Yeah, I would echo what Sam is saying, just the validation, because a lot of times we've raised issues and have been told that it's not true. Our experience is not actually happening. Been working on this for a little bit less time than Sam, but a long time. And then my own daughter got suspended as well 4 years ago. And it just took me into, you know, a rabbit hole kind of, and all the students that we've worked with, all the families, there was nothing that was necessarily surprising, but just reading through all of those pages, detailing out, you know, really in black and white and in legal language, and that a thorough investigation was conducted, the numbers that were out there, the things that we had said, was encouraging to see, right? It's been hard work. We never were sure if it was going to get validated and we would actually have an assurance of discontinuance, as the Attorney General's office calls it. So we're feeling really encouraged that all these years of work and a lot of sacrifices that parents, students, and advocates have made have got us across this really key threshold.
And if I could add one other thing, we kind of get the information anecdotally. You know, we hear about the real situations that's happening to actual parents and mm-hmm. students. But to see it written and just how stark, you know, and just really, you know, the good job the Attorney General did just capturing just the outright, you know, violations and the impact of them. It was really, you know, it really grabbed you. It was like, wow, you know, I mean, so we really happy with the work that the Attorney General did to really validate what, you know, parents have been experiencing.
Yes. And to your point, the stories are impactful, but to see that in black and white, it certainly makes it that much more important to realize what a dire situation this is about how our school district has been handling disciplinary actions. Before we get into the AG's report a little bit more, because you both speak from personal experience, I would love to hear a little bit about your backgrounds and how you got into this work and exactly where that validation comes from and what you've seen in this report as you've explained it.
Yeah, so I've been part of the District Parent Coordinating Council since 2006. And I remember in 2007, actually, is the first time we actually had a community forum on suspension. 1,700 kids had got suspended in 1 month.
Wow.
And so we had started advocating on it. But then in 2010, June of 2010, a young man, Jawan Daniels, was caught in a hallway sweep at school. And he was illegally suspended. He was suspended for something he should not have been suspended for. And when he was suspended and sent home without nobody communicating to his parents, he was just sent home out of the building. He was at the bus stop and was shot and killed at the bus stop. And, you know, that was really a turning point for us as parents and parent leaders, understanding that, you know, these unjust suspensions, these suspensions that shouldn't be taking place, was a matter of life and death for our children. And we just could not, you know, continue to sit by and let the district, you know, just do suspensions the way they were suspending students. And so we began to advocate, you know, in 2010. And so it went through many phases. I'm sure we'll cover through the course of the show. But ultimately, you know, another really important point in that process was the Education Trust did a policy brief called
Stolen Time,
you know, where they captured, you know, where Buffalo is one of the leading districts in suspension in the state. And so that's at that point we were able to get the Attorney General involved and really start to move the dial on making sure that Jawan Daniels' death wasn't in vain, mm-hmm. that he died, but we would make changes to prevent that from happening to other children. And ultimately, we didn't expect it to take this long, but, you know, ultimately, we believe we got to a place where now it's going to be much more difficult for that type of suspension to take place.
Yeah, and I got involved a little while after that. You know, my children were very small at that time, and you get involved and you start advocating based on your own experience. You know, at that point, I remember my daughter was in kindergarten and she was acting up in her kindergarten class. And when I talked to the teacher about it, she said, you know, she can't sit down. She's just moving and like not staying in her seat. And I said, okay, well, when is recess? And she said, we don't have recess in kindergarten. I said, well, when is gym class? And she said, oh, they only get gym class once a week. So that was sort of one of the beginning campaigns that I had is, you know, understanding the root causes of why children are quote unquote acting out, right? My daughter not being able to sit in her seat as a 5-year-old wasn't because she didn't know how to listen or follow the rules. It was because she was a normal, healthy 5-year-old who needed to move, right?
And yeah, that's not unheard of.
We had to do a whole campaign to get recess back in the schools. Yeah. And people didn't even realize that it was gone. Senior district officials didn't realize it. We did a whole rally for recess in front of City Hall and before a board meeting. And so I say that to put this in the context as a larger public health issue, because I'm a community health worker. And we sometimes see this issue of suspension is like, oh, kids are being bad and they need to like listen, right? And not to say that kids don't have problematic behavior sometimes, but it's really been understanding the root causes of behavior and for us working towards change so we can create healthier and more supportive environments. And that's what our whole campaign has been here. Solutions, not suspensions, right? Jawan Daniels, I was not involved in that time, but I've heard this story so many times and it just breaks my heart because these are literal life and death situations. This child was roaming the halls and was suspended, sent home, and shot and killed. That didn't need to happen. And there's so many other situations that didn't need to happen. And if my daughter, when she was young, and I had a really supportive teacher in school at that point where we were able to not only come up with a solution, luckily her kindergarten teacher was also a dance teacher and integrated a lot of movement to make sure that those kids could get up and move and call me and have a parent-teacher conversation. But we work with very small children. That was one of the pieces of our campaign. Do not suspend pre-K through third graders. What is a small child doing that is suspendable, right? Which was validated by the Attorney General's report. But this is all informed by our lived experiences and tracking with our own children and families and accompanying them through this process. And again, if my child hadn't had me, she didn't get suspended when she was small. But by the time she was a teenager and she wasn't getting her needs met, she was acting out. Mm-hmm. She was making sure that her needs were going to get met, right? And so this is what we need to do, is make sure that we understand the root causes of behavior, that this is a mental, emotional, and behavioral health issue. And we need to find ways where we can come up with more proactive restorative solutions to address these issues and not push kids out of school.
And I think also it became almost like the district culture. You know, just suspending kids without really looking for, you know, solutions, suspending kids as if it was a solution.
Yeah.
And we were able to early on mobilize and get the policy change, get a new code of conduct. And so we thought by, you know, getting the policy change that ultimately would lead to, you know, a change in behavior. And we found out the hard way that because you put some a policy on paper, don't change people's behavior.
It does not.
And that was a shock in itself. You know, that was a big win to get the board to vote in place of, we have one of the best code of conducts in the state. And it just turned out to be that if people behavior don't change, that code of conduct is just words on paper. That's the significance of the AOD. The AOD means assurance of discontinuance. It means people were violating the law and now they have to assure the Attorney General that they're going to discontinue to violate the law. You know what I'm saying? So it was a real validation that, you know, first of all, the code of conduct went in the right direction, but it really required oversight and people to implement with fidelity.
And to your point, I think that is maybe one of the most alarming parts of this investigation, is that the school district did engage in unlawful practices. That's daunting for both parents and students to hear that this educational system that we trust, you know, they're violating processes, due process, inconsistent procedures, reports of retaliation were mentioned. I want to get into how this is impacting the individual household.
Yeah, significantly on lots of levels, right? I mean, think about yourself as a parent. You're getting a call from the school. Sometimes one of the issues that was raised was, you know, not unlawful suspensions, just sending kids home from school. So we had a lot of situations where something was happening in a school building, many times children with disabilities for behaviors that were protected under the law, and said, you know, Johnny's having a bad day, maybe you should come pick him up and take him home, right? Sometimes even saying maybe you should keep him home for a couple days. That's excluding a child from home from school. You should not be doing that without documenting it. And we were having a lot of situations like that where a child was being excluded from school or sent home from school without it being logged as a suspension.
And I suspect a lot of people didn't even realize that is an unlawful suspension.
Right. So there's you know, procedures and laws that need to be followed related to that. So that's kind of like the first layer, right? The second layer is a short-term suspension, which is anything from 1 to 5 days. And so that's to the principal's discretion, but they still, by law, need to send a notice home. That has to be given to the child, to the family, needs to be assured that the parent received it, and the child can't be excluded from school until the family receives that letter, which was regularly happening once again. Parents sometimes not even getting those suspension letters, just getting a call from the school. The parent also has a right to have a parent conference. That is stated in the letter, but a lot of times that wasn't happening. That's really up for the parent to know. And if a parent can negotiate something and say, like, I don't think this is right, and work through it, then the child needs to be returned to school. If the behavior was related to their disability, the child needs to be returned to school. A lot of times, though, by the time you can get this sorted out, parents are working, parents are dealing with other kids as well. A lot of times parents would just be like, all right, I'll just take it. I'll just pick my kid up from school, or I'll take the, you know, 1 to 5 day suspension. We also felt like usually those suspensions were being maxed out at 5 days, which the AOD also in the findings said those suspensions were usually at 5 days. If the principal could suspend up to 5 days, they were generally suspending 5 days, right? And then you go to the long-term suspensions, which are 6 days up to 180 days, a whole entire school year. And we've dealt with families who've been dealing with that, and those situations are so heartbreaking. I mean, missing 5 days of school is pretty significant in terms of getting set back, right? Because the kids are home, they're supposed to get alternate instruction, but very few of them are really getting that. It may be virtual, right? They're not, it's not the same as being in school.
Yeah, and you can lose a lot in a week.
Yes. So imagine if you're out of school for months to up to an entire year. And going into these suspension hearings, the suspension hearings, they happen at City Hall. The parent needs to be there for the suspension hearing to run. You have a hearing officer, which is a employee of the district that is quote unquote impartial. And it's like a court proceeding. So you're read your rights. You have a right to an attorney or an advocate. Most parents don't realize that even though it's in the letter, there's all kind of issues. Like the average literacy level for our parents is a third grade reading level. This is a legal document. This is a legal proceeding. So I remember the first time I was an advocate in a long-term suspension hearing. It was extremely intimidating. I didn't realize what I was walking into. And from there on out, if I was dealing with a family who was in a long-term suspension hearing, and this is where our community partnerships have been really helpful, I say get a lawyer. Because especially if it's certain charges, they can be very serious and exclude you up to school for an entire school year. So it's overwhelming in a lot of ways for parents to be managing this situation, the risk that's involved in terms of long-term exclusion from school, the way that it's set up, and the administrators and the witnesses are joining virtually. You're sitting in there with a hearing officer. You don't really know how to come and be prepared around this stuff, and you're pleading guilty, not guilty, or partially guilty. It's a very overwhelming experience. So I think just taking into account this whole system, and I would argue it's a system of oppression and a system of exclusion. And I think that the Attorney General showed that in terms of just the sheer volume of suspensions that were happening, the disparities around suspensions related to race and related to special education and disabilities, related to income. It's a system that needs to be dismantled from a punitive to a restorative system.
I want to delve deeper into those disparities and also, once again, building on the unlawful practices, especially this may be more tailored to you, Sam, in the years you've been doing this work. Some of the dire findings from this investigation also concluded that Black students were 6 times more likely than their white counterparts to be suspended. Latinos were 4 times as likely. And there was also a disproportionate rate of students with disabilities being suspended. These are groups who already, based on their race, ethnicity, and ability status, feel like they are others, so to speak, in the world. Because, you know, when they're in school, they have this image of this is what I'm going to be entering into in society. What is this showing them that, you know, there appears to be these targets just because of who they are demographically? What does that do to a student? And what does that tell them about the world they're entering into?
Yeah, it just reinforces all the stereotypes. I mean, at the end of the day, it tells a student, you know, ultimately, when you look at the academic outcomes we got in the district, you know what I'm saying, they parallel that. You know, basically, if you look at the academic outcomes for low-income people of color, you know, students with disabilities, you know, most students, we got less than 3 out of 10 students who are reading, writing, and doing math on grade level, graduating college and career ready. Because at the end of the day, I mean, what's happening to you in the classroom? It could take away your just love for going to school or even wanting to be in school. And so consequently, you know, we have a culture, you know, first of all, if you just look at the demographics in the district, you know, 84% of the teachers are white, you know, 70% of them don't live, you know, in the context of, you know, where these children are coming from. And not necessarily say that that's a determinant factor, but the point is that that cultural disconnect has an impact. And not to be to the point that Jessica made earlier, to not have a restorative process to where, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to get to the root cause of what's going on. To have a process where we're just trying to push kids out to get the problem from in front of us, kick it down the road. Really, I mean, it's discouraging. It's discouraging for parents. It's discouraging for students. And ultimately, you get that kind of outcomes we're getting academically and, you know, socially, emotionally, and culturally in terms of what's going on in the district.
Right. And in looking at that representation of, like you said, not a lot of educators look like their students. I imagine it's like that in the realm of healthcare professionals or guidance counselors who may be available in those schools. You know, the limited amount of resources that we do have to offer counseling, a lot of times they don't look like the Black student or the Latino student. They don't look like the disabled student. So what does that lack of representation across the board really mean in terms of playing into disciplinary actions?
Yeah, I think that there's disconnects. And when you look at suspension charges, right, because they need to be classified, that was one of our major issues as well, because they were charges like disrespect, insubordination, defiance of authority, which oftentimes are misunderstandings. And I have been involved in so many situations, you know, parent conferences, suspension hearings, also training in restorative practices. So restorative conferencing, where it's a relationship breakdown and it's a lack of understanding. It's something a child said or did because they weren't in a good place necessarily, because they're still children, right? They do things that are impulsive. Some of the things that they're bringing from home may not be the things that the staff is dealing with, right? Just because the environments that our children are coming from. Sometimes things are cultural, and there's just, it seems disrespectful to you, but that is just cultural, right? That's a different tone that we're using. It's a different way that we're presenting ourselves. And so assuming good intent and understanding like what might be going on underneath the surface here, and having the understanding to even ask those questions, right? Like, we use a practice where we do check-ins, like, how are you doing today on a scale of 1 to 5? And you can even do it within a classroom context where the kids just raise their hand and put the number up. If you see that you've got, you know, everybody's at a 4 or a 5, but you've got 1 or 2 kids at a 1 or a 2, and then they show attitude towards you later, maybe there's something else going on there. It may not be personal, right? Mm-hmm. So just building those relationships and understanding, we don't know what we don't know. And I think especially right now, there's always differences between generations, but we also have a youth community health worker program where we recruit young people, many of whom we've met when they have gotten in trouble in suspension hearings and whatnot, because they have this spirit about them. They are trying to express themselves in some way. They're trying to let us know what they need. They're trying to defend themselves or their peers, right? Sometimes not in the best possible way, but in the only way that they know how. And being able to understand that from a generational perspective, these are kids, right? And the environment they're living in sometimes is wild, and they're not getting their needs met, and we're not adapting as adults sometimes and trying to meet them where they're at. And that's our job as adults, right? Because we're the adults. I think a lot of these dynamics are at play in a way that we don't have a system right now that's really, it's not working for the kids, it's not working for the adults either, right? Because I've heard a lot of teachers and administrators say, and we've got a lot that are allies too, as we talk about a lot of the problems, there are a lot of people who are trying, and we don't have the right infrastructure in place. And I think that's where the opportunity is here, because it is challenging with the tools that teachers and administrators have at their disposal right now to have a restorative approach, to have the time and energy to have a restorative conference, to bring people in who are of and from community that have context of where our families are coming from, to help address what happened, what were you thinking at the time, how can we make this right. It is an intensive process. It's more time and energy on the front end. It saves you a lot of time and energy and builds stronger relationships in the long run, but it's a real culture shift that I think we need to engage in.
One of the issues with the culture is that, as this report has outlined, instead of restorative practices, we're seeing retaliation. As you mentioned, we have the highest suspension rates in New York State for the past 7 years we have. And we're seeing some educators threaten families to report them to Child Protective Services because they are issuing an egregious amount of suspensions. I just wanted to, because honestly, that's a part of it that I still can't fully wrap my head around. So I just want to get into that a little bit, this suspension as retaliation and other forms of reporting as retaliation.
Yeah, this is, it's difficult to talk about because it's happened to me directly. It's happened to a lot of parents and students who have stood up for ourselves. I understand we don't always see things the same way, but the things that have happened, and again, this is where the AOD is validating, because things that were said and done to us when we were just standing up for ourselves, trying to protect our own children, the fact that it even happened to the children themselves, in ways that sometimes were underhanded and sometimes very overt, is troubling. And the fact that the attorney general looked into that and was able to document it, but it hasn't happened to just me. It's happened to lots of other parents. And sometimes it's really hard to stay in the fight. And that's why we need a community of support, because I would not be able to still be here, have my children in Buffalo Public Schools, if I didn't have Brother Sam and attorneys and other parents that really stood with me, and people in the district as well, right, who are really trying to do the right thing. But we are a threat to the system. We are a threat to the structure as it is. And it's been difficult, but this is not new to us as advocates either. We know that we have to fight for our rights, and that people always don't want to work with us for that, right? Because it means giving power to families in a way that families haven't been given power. So just watching that play out, seeing how this is, like, I think Sam said this before, it's sort of been normalized that this is how parents and students are treated. And that when we say we know our rights, that's seen as a threat versus everybody should have rights. You know, we all are afforded rights. Teachers and administrators have rights too, but so do we as families.
We will be right back with more What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media and NPR.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station. You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And we're back with What's Next, joined once again by Jessica Bauer-Walker and Sam Radford. We're continuing this discussion on the AG's investigation into school suspensions. We left off at talking about the necessary support for parents who are really doing the work, which ultimately sparked this investigation. The Attorney General took a look at these suspensions because of the work of parent advocates. So I want to continue getting into a little bit more about that support and why it's necessary to continue this movement.
Yeah. So again, we as parents were raising these issues. I had an issue where my own daughter was suspended and I needed help. Sam referred me to an attorney, Carly Height, who was working with Legal Aid Bureau of Buffalo, who was able to represent us. And again, very difficult situation. And without support from an attorney and others, me and my family wouldn't have been able to get through that. We weren't able to fight the suspension. It was a short-term suspension, so we had to serve that out. But there were some issues with the suspension. And so there's something, again, only a parent can do, is file an appeal with the state education department. It's called a 310 appeal. And so that is something that is quite overwhelming. You have to put together all the documentation and put a filing into the state education department. But Carly was willing to do that with me, and we were willing to do it as parents. It's time and energy. Again, this is why this system continues to perpetuate itself, because many times the suspension experience itself is pretty traumatic. Usually there's a traumatic incident that's associated with it, especially if your child was in a fight or something like that, or trying to defend themselves. But we were willing to work together as a team with support from others and get that filed. And it takes a while to get a ruling back. It takes 6 months plus, but we got the ruling back and we were successful in the ruling. But even with that, things did not change, because it needs to be more than just one person. And so through that process, our attorney was working with so many different families that she could see. She let us know. She validated our experience. Before we got the attorney general's office, she said, no, I'm seeing this across the board. I'm seeing this with Black families. I'm seeing this with children who have disabilities. And so we started to coalesce as families, and she contacted the New York Civil Liberties Union and brought them in. Western New York Law Center, UB Law School, we started to organize and say, who else could help us with this? And so within a couple months, we had a really diverse coalition of families, of academics, of attorneys, of advocates, of restorative practitioners. And we started to really dig in and share, look at the data. One of the good practices that BPS has is they have a data dashboard. And so you can go on there and you can see data. Now, there's some issues with the data dashboard, which was raised in the Attorney General's report, too. But it's a great starting point, right? We can work to get some more clarity on some of the data points and practices, but we have a base to work from. And so our academics and researchers were able to do a deep dive in there and pull out that data. The restorative practitioners, we started an initiative to cross-train parents and students as community health workers, restorative facilitators, and family advocates so that they could defend themselves and each other. And we said, you know, let's actually document this at this point. And so we started an effort to write up a white paper with kind of similar to what the Attorney General's office did, but we weren't going to wait for the Attorney General's office. We were in conversation with them. They started to investigate, but we knew it's going to take years for them to do an investigation. And they had already started an investigation before COVID, right? And then it had paused and kind of died. And so we're like, we need to reactivate this. We need to reactivate the community around this. So we started an effort to conduct our own research and outline our own findings and our own experiences and suggestions. You want to add on to that, Sam, at all?
Yeah, I think what it ultimately came down to is that in order for us to confront the fact that the district was basically in denial about, you know, what they were doing. In other words, they were acting as if, you know, everything was fine. And so we had to, you know, go through the process of showing and proving that there were violations of the law that was going on. And obviously parents wasn't enough. You know what I'm saying? We had to really get the research and get the data to show what was going on. And, you know, to the point that Jessica made, you know, we started this originally, we started with the Attorney General's office. The conversation started in 2016. And then by 2019, you know, it looked like there was getting ready to be something that was going to happen. And then COVID happened and then everything stopped. And then they had to pick up again in 2023. And ultimately, you know, this was an uphill push all the way. It didn't just happen by itself. You know, every step of the way we had to inform what was going on. They had to come here and meet with parents and hear the testimony of parents. And so parents had to talk about what's going on. We had to have Know Your Rights forums so parents would know that you can't just come pick your child up. You have to make sure they document it. I mean, so it was really, really, really a struggle, a battle to get here, you know. And so now to be at a place where you have the Attorney General saying, we are going to provide oversight. We're not going to leave it up to you. You know what I'm saying? There's a whole series of things that they're doing. They're going to have a person in every building, a building level monitor to monitor what's going on. They're going to have a district ombudsman. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They have a person that's going to report directly to the Attorney General to monitor what's going on for 4 years. You know what I'm saying? So now we got some teeth, you know, into what's going on, which puts us in a position to where ultimately what we want to get to is where we're not talking about suspensions as a solution. We're really talking about a more restorative process. The district says a restorative district, but it's not implementing a restorative model. So we want to get to a model where kids come to school to be educated. And when there are problems, there we human beings are going to be problems. How do we figure out how to solve those problems and make sure we keep kids in the classroom, get them a great education, and going on and have a successful life? And so we feel like now we've turned a corner because there is an accountability mechanism to where, you know, if people violate the law now, you got the Attorney General. It ain't just parents, you know, or community groups, but you now got the power of government to come in and hold the district accountable.
Exactly. And I want to get into, speaking of accountability, something that you both touched on, the fact that what's been outlined in the AG's report has really always been out there. As you said, the data, the dashboards have been out there. As you mentioned, Sam, the parent testimonies have been out there. Does it make you feel a little frustrated that it took the Attorney General putting her name on this for people to really look at it as a big issue, given the years and years of work that you've dedicated to this? I mean, I know there's a sense of gratitude, but does it also, you know, what does it look like in the context of the long fight you all have been fighting?
Yeah, there's no question that it's been frustrating. I mean, even after the Attorney General report, if you go and look in some of the comments in the chat room, people acting like, you know, we making this stuff up. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, we're doing something that we're taking away the power that the teacher have to, you know, to manage their classroom some kind of way. No. As if, you know, and so, yeah, it is a bit frustrating. But like you said, we're happy that we're at this point. But, you know, people's response is as if we did something, you know, as opposed to something was being done to us and our children.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is how power operates. Like Frederick Douglass said, power seeds nothing without a demand. And we've been putting our demands out there. And the system doesn't like that necessarily, right? Everybody, you know, has their own interests. And we see things differently. And that's okay. It's okay to represent your own interests. But parents and students don't have a union. Everybody else does in Buffalo Public Schools. And we're the most oppressed group. And like Sam was saying before, a vast majority of the people who work in Buffalo Public Schools don't send their kids to Buffalo Public Schools and don't even live in the city of Buffalo. And so there's going to be some disconnects, you know? So we need to build those bridges, right? Just that's the history of this country and in this world is recognizing like we go, that's what democracy is. So
yeah,
if we believe in that, then we need to say like conflict is not a bad thing, right? And this is where the framework of us bringing solutions and this restorative model. And it's again, I keep saying this, it's a culture shift because we keep saying shifting from a punitive to a restorative system. I have had people say to me multiple times, like, oh, we'll have a restorative, but there's going to be consequences first. Without an understanding, the accountability and consequences that come from a restorative process is much more than a suspension. Because trust me, a lot of our kids, especially by the time they're in high school and they can have continued to be pushed out, they'll stay home and play video games for the day instead of having to go to school. That has nothing to do with whatever the behavior was, right? It's not resolving it. Whereas a restorative process really delves into that and helps children to understand what is going on. And sometimes it's no fault of their own. Sometimes it was a poor choice that they made and they have an opportunity to remedy that. And they have an opportunity to learn. And we've seen children who've made mistakes, who are escalated, be able to de-escalate, take responsibility for the behavior, apologize in ways that have so many impacts, right? In terms of their own awareness, the relationships with the adults in the building, the adults' level of awareness, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a structured process. There's some stuff that's just basic community building. So we have more relationships. Like I said, that check-in, it's such a simple tool, but it can be really transformative just to make sure, are we all okay today, right? And if we're not, what can we do, right? And that's why we've done a lot of complementary work, like getting breakfast in the classroom programs and school food and recess, right? Like we all need to be mentally, behaviorally, emotionally, spiritually, like okay, right? And we want our staff to be okay too. So I think that's like a lot of the framework is how can we all be okay here? We want our teachers and administrators and building staff to be okay too. If there's a violent environment in the school building, we don't want that to be the case. We don't want children to do whatever they feel like doing. Again, we're the adults, we're in charge, but we need to make sure that our children are healthy, safe, and supportive. And there's lots of tools and strategies and good research and best practices around restorative versus punitive approaches and that they work, right? And even in terms of better academic outcomes. I mean, obviously children are not going to be able to learn and do well if they're not in school. So to me, that seems pretty foundational. But there's so much research out here just in terms of social emotional learning and using restorative versus exclusionary school discipline that we should all really be invested in.
And the irony here is that, you know, we have a situation where, you know, teachers and administrators are holding students accountable. But when it turns out that they violated the students' rights, you know what I'm saying? There's nobody holding them accountable. In other words, they get to violate the students' rights and then, you know, or we get a suspension overturned and it turned out they shouldn't have been suspended, or there's nobody coming back and saying, whoa, you didn't follow the proper procedure here. Mm-hmm. And consequently, somebody was out of school unnecessarily. Yeah. Somebody was impacted by that. And so they have the ability to have impacts on our community. And so So we ultimately have to take full and complete responsibility for systems change. We have to make sure we fight to be in the system that we want to be in. We can't just let people impose systems on us. And it's kind of what was going on. And so, you know, getting that validated by the Attorney General really, really mattered. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, ultimately, you know, accountability is, if you, especially if you're going to hold the child accountable, we all have to be accountable, you know, in a way to make this an environment that we all want to, you know, thrive in.
Certainly. So before we hop into another break here, I do want to circle back on something that you both mentioned, which honestly is kind of a surprise to me, that there's almost this blame of parents since this report has been released, as if, you know, like you said, as if something hasn't been done to you. If we're going to move forward and working in a collaborative effort and realizing that conflict doesn't equal war, what is it going to take to realize that the advocacy you all are putting forward isn't simply pointing fingers and blaming folks, but it's forging real change that's going to benefit everyone all around, from the educators to the students?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we are looking to see what the implementation is going to be, right? We know, like, kind of the nuts and bolts, the things that are on paper and the assurance of discontinuance, but it's going to require us coming to the table. We can't work in silos. We can only do this together. So that's what we've been saying all along, is we've been trying to push this over the finish line for the past 6 months in particular, to say, we want to do this. And I really congratulate the superintendent and the Board of Education and some cabinet members who have said, you know what, we do have a problem, because they could have fought this. They didn't have to sign off on this. So Dr. Mbenga coming in, and the board members, especially because we have new board members and others who helped to get this done, the legal department, we appreciate them too. And I think we do need to come back to the table in a restorative way and recognize this came at a cost to us, for sure, right? And some people in the system that advocated, it came at a cost to them too. So how do we heal that to some degree and then move forward in a collaborative spirit?
Very good points to raise. And with that, we will take another short break. When we come back to What's Next, we're going to get into the agreement between the AG's office and the Buffalo Public School System, seeing, as you said, Sam, if this really does have teeth, what, if any, difference this is going to make in the disciplinary actions we see. When we return to What's Next, stay with us on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love, listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media at The Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station. You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And this is What's Next. Welcome back. Continuing and wrapping up this discussion on suspensions in the Buffalo Public School System, the Attorney General's investigation, and what comes next. There was an agreement that has been reached. I do want to know what this looks like. Does this seem realistic for us to implement the things that have been outlined as possible solutions to quell the suspensions we're seeing? I'm interested in hearing from both of you.
Sam's going to start us off.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I think, you know, first of all, let me just say that this is not the first AOD. In New York State, Syracuse had an AOD before we had an AOD. And in Syracuse, they, within 2-3 years, their suspensions were cut in half, right?
Wow.
Which is really encouraging, right? And so But it really comes down to how people implement, you know what I'm saying? And people in Buffalo are not people in Syracuse, right? So it's really going to require the people to buy in, and it's going to require, you know, all of us working together to, you know, get a better result, you know what I'm saying? So I do think, you know, having a the Attorney General, having a person that reports directly to the Attorney General who's monitoring, you know, on the month-to-month basis, and having a person that's in the superintendent's cabinet, an ombudsman, to who's getting building level reports, you know, as they occur. I do think that level of, you know, oversight, that level of, you know, putting light on a situation makes it much more difficult for people just to be openly, you know, violating the law like they were doing. And also, you know, to Jessica's point earlier, I do think, you know, this is a different superintendent. You know, this superintendent, you know, seems to be interested in, you know, holding people accountable. And so we got a new school board. So I'm optimistic that, you know, but I'm optimistic and paying attention at the same time. I don't think it's going to happen by itself.
Yeah. Oversight is apparently key here.
Exactly.
Yeah, the system doesn't change itself. We even saw, you know, the district made some changes last year before the AOD to take out some of those subjective classifications like we talked about before, like disrespect and defiance of authority. And we saw very quickly a rapid movement to the charge of inciting or participating in a disturbance. So then that was kind of the catch-all charge, right? Because you can kind of put a lot of stuff in there. So some of those things will need to be addressed. But I think there's a very functional structure that's in place with that independent monitor. And that person is an outside independent monitor, which will be helpful. The ombudsman, I think having somebody that's not in student support services. So the system can't monitor itself. There needs to be somebody external, right? So even though that's a district person, having it outside of the current infrastructure that oversees suspensions is probably the best idea, right? And then those school-based coordinators, you know, I think that because of the administrator's contract, that will most likely be principals. But the fact that there's a structure that's in place, as well as additional remedies around putting restorative practices in place, cleaning up some of these practices that are quote-unquote unlawful, just shoring up processes, different ways that suspensions are reported and cleaning up of the data dashboard. So there's accountability and transparency to the public there. Some of these things will really help us to have more accountability.
It certainly looks promising, especially because we have seen this type of success in different school districts with similar agreements. But I am wondering, for Buffalo Public Schools, what does this look like implementing across the board, given that certain schools have more problems or different demographics of students that are disproportionately suspended or have these issues? So are these solutions a cure-all to our school system? Do you think maybe some schools will have more trouble implementing them? What is this actually going to look like?
Yeah, certain schools will definitely have more challenges. There's some schools who are doing this well, and we have to look where there's good things happening too and learn from that, because some schools have much lower suspension rates. Sometimes it's because of their base of their student population. We've talked about for years the fact that we have a multi-tiered school system. You shouldn't have a city honors and some of our non-criteria schools in the same school system and feel okay with that because of the disparate outcomes on academics, attendance, behavior, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. We definitely have some administrators who they've had their own restorative training and they really believe in this and they have been doing their best to implement. So they'll have a much easier time and their suspension rates are already lower. There's some schools who they don't philosophically believe in this. They think that they should be able to suspend, and suspension is not necessarily a bad thing. So that is one of the things that we've talked about too, is consistency, right? Equity is a little bit different than everything being the same, but we need to have a lot more consistency than we currently have across the school district.
I think two things. One is leadership is going to matter. I mean, to the extent that leadership takes responsibility for what's going on in the district, you don't have to have the attorney general. You know what I'm saying? Leadership matters. And I also think that, you know, the continuation of making sure a student and parent voice is respected in this conversation, because ultimately this is happening to a student. You know what I'm saying? This is happening to a family. You know what I'm saying? So if we listen to students and parents and get to a place where their voice is part of, you know, how we, you know, make this district better, I think, you know, this could be a turning point. But I think it's going to be hard. I mean, change is hard. We learned that when we got a change on paper. Change in behavior is different than changing on paper. And so people are going to have to go through some growing pains. And, you know, on some level, you know, somebody may have to be held accountable, you know, before people take it seriously. Right. But hopefully not. You know, if you got great leadership, they can hold people accountable and then people will take it seriously. But if not, we have the attorney generals, you know, sitting there saying that you cannot openly violate the law without consequence.
That attorney general oversight is certainly going to be key. And all of this, as you said, it does look great on paper. When you think about, though, moving forward and having those necessary conversations between the parents and the leaders in the school districts, without there being any hard feelings, any egos, you know, paperwork aside, what is that going to look like? What do you think that's going to take to really be able to sit down at a table and discuss the best outcomes for the students?
Yeah, I think that builds on the point that Sam is making around collaborative leadership. And Dr. Mbenga has said that too. You know, he really wants to see not hierarchical leadership, but collaborative leadership. And we fully support that. We don't think that we know everything. We don't think that anybody knows everything, right? We've put a model out of school wellness teams that have everybody at the table that are necessary for the students to be healthy and whole. That includes the building engineer. That includes the food service person. That includes parents and students and community partners and the phys ed teacher, right? If you can build a team of people that can talk across difference and can problem solve together, and I've seen this so many times when people are willing to come together and realize what they know and what they don't know, and that we can talk to directly impacted people. I think if we listen to and stay grounded with the students, and especially our high school students, but even our little ones, if you know how to ask them the right questions, they tell you what you need to know. They know what they need, right?
Yeah.
People that are closest to the problems are the closest to the solutions. And I think if we have a mindset shift towards that and don't take things personally and can really come together, name the things, have direct, honest conversation, and really want to build healthy, strong relationships, we can do this.
And a really good sign is if anybody who's read the superintendent's 100-day report, he talked about this. He talked about the inconsistency of implementation, you know, across the districts. It was some schools doing some things, the other schools doing other things. But he also talked about the value of family and community engagement. You know what I'm saying? So his initial assessment is right on, is spot on. He's really captured what's going on. So the question is, with that baseline, you know, now we got a vision of us all working together in the best interest of children, making sure all of our children, you know, read, write, and do math on grade level, graduate college and career ready, have a social, emotional, supportive environment. Those are things that we all want. Now the question is, how do we all work together and get there? You know what I'm saying? So I think the superintendent is off to a good start along those lines.
Final question. Some of these will be quick to implement, some of these settlement required reforms, like the code of conduct, but some may take a little longer, you know, from the faculty training to the data transparency. Realistically, in these last couple of minutes, what do you think that timeline is going to be?
Yeah, I think it's going to need a timeline. I think it's going to need to be kind of process mapped out, right? And what can we do to get things started? How do we build collaborative effort? I'm hoping that we can, all the stakeholders, leaderships from all the groups can come together so that we can come up with a plan. I know the district has done quite a bit of training around positive behavior interventions and what's in the code of conduct and restorative practices. I think there's a lot of family and community expertise around that, and to recognize that and bring that in too, not have a restorative practices training for the administrators separate from the teachers, separate from the parents and the students. How can we come together and learn and grow together? I think that's a missing ingredient. And if we can figure out how to start to do some of that, sooner rather than later, it'll make a real positive difference, because then we can work together to get things done.
And I think, you know, on timeline, we have to have a sense of urgency, though. We can't, you know, just say it's going to take a while and then we're just going to be patient. And I think this is, we talk about students' lives. Students don't get an extra year of that. You're only in fifth grade for 1 year, sixth grade for, you know, so we got to have a sense of urgency with how to make sure these environments are conducive to student learning and student thriving. And I think that this AOD gives us that sense of urgency. And so I think it'll move pretty, you know, rapidly.
Urgency is definitely key. As you mentioned, a great point about seeing these changes before the students age out of the school system.
Yeah. That's critically important, because my daughter is aged out, right? Like, she did this work and she's happy to see some resolution to what she went through, but it's not impacting her directly. A lot of the students that fought and suffered consequences from this, they're not benefiting from it. And so systems don't have the same sense of urgency that students and parents do. And so I think that's a really good point that Sam made, right? We have a very short window of time where we're raising our children, and that they have the opportunity to be in school. And again, I think if we put our minds and heads and spirits in this, we can get it done and get it done quickly.
Collaboration will certainly be key. I think, as has been mentioned several times today, oversight is going to be the most important part here, not just from the Attorney General, but from us as a community at large. And with that, I would like to thank you so much again, Jessica Bauer Walker and Sam Radford, for joining me and continuing this discussion on suspensions. Hopefully next time we all sit together, it'll be around some data that shows that the numbers have dramatically decreased.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.